This was meant to be the sermon for last week, part two of a continuing series through the book of Daniel, and especially the narrative portions of Daniel. As Adventists, we understand Daniel to be one of the bedrock prophetic books in our understanding of the end time scenarios and the events which will unfold for us as we await Jesus' second coming. And it's not only the visions and the prophecies that we need to study to understand the God who we're waiting for. We need to study the stories as well. And so this story, the third chapter, is vital for understanding how to remain committed and loyal to our God. Because the enemy has different plans for us. In this fascinating story, three men, and only three men are recorded to stand and defy the king's order to worship an idol. And I want to introduce you to three other men who you may have heard about recently. This is the crew of the Apollo 11 mission. And have you caught the moon fever yet? There's been 50 years have passed since the landing on the moon. And it was July 20, just last month, 1969, 50 years ago, that Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and one other man, I don't have his name there, Collins, that's right, they went and landed on the moon, and it was Neil and Buzz that got out of the capsule and landed. And it was such a momentum. How many of you remember watching that live when you were alive? I think, obviously you were alive. I was not alive. Thank you. That comes to you from the Department of Redundancy Department, right? All kidding aside, it took many years of preparation leading up to that mission on July 20. And as this is known as Apollo 11, there was a tragedy that occurred on the Apollo 1 team. This is the crew of Apollo 1, Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee. They were preparing for their first Apollo mission on the Saturn V rocket, a new rocket that had performed greatly in testing. Their mission was service and preparing to launch on February 21, 1967, the day of my birthday, which was 1975. But their mission never flew, and they were going to just do a low Earth orbit. They were not going to exit from and make the orbits and launch towards the moon. They were just going to go around the Earth. But on January 27, a test within their capsule sparked a fire. And these three astronauts lost their life in that test. And because of the heat, you see, they would pipe in pure oxygen into the module that they were in. And as soon as a spark lit, the oxygen just exploded. And because of the way the hatch was designed, the safety crews couldn't get to them. They didn't even really know there was a fire happening because there was communication problems as well. And this is a picture of what it looked like inside of the capsule after the bodies were removed, obviously. But this was an incredible fiery furnace. And so I introduced you to those men to help you understand not only was there Apollo 11 and the following Apollo missions that landed on the cruise, but there was significant sacrifice given for these various missions. And that's why people get passionate about hearing conspiracy theories about the moon and so on and so forth, because this wasn't a publicity stunt. This was real. Changes in safety features after the Apollo 1 disaster were made, and they began to pump in a mixture of nitrogen and oxygen, and they adjusted the hatch to make it easier for the crew outside to open the hatch from the outside to let them in. But the fiery furnace of Daniel chapter 3 was heated to a blistering temperature. So much so that even those soldiers that threw in the Hebrew worthies couldn't survive the heat that came from inside. By the deliverance of his faithful servants, Ellen White writes in Prophets and Kings, the Lord declared that he takes his stand with the oppressed and rebukes all earthly powers that rebel against the authority of heaven. The three Hebrews declared to the whole nation of Babylon their faith in him whom they worshiped. They relied on God. And that's a lesson for us in this day and age. We may not have to face a fiery furnace or worshiping an idol upon pain of death, but we have tests in our Christian walk all of the time, every single day. And it's whether we compromise on those little tiny tests that will prove ultimately if we pass the ultimate test when we're asked to remain loyal to God. There was a prophecy in Isaiah that these three Hebrews knew very well. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they will not overflow you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be scorched, nor will the flame burn you. Incidentally, this was a key text that we chose when we founded the wakeboarding club at Southern Adventist University, because we liked that passage about going through the waters. But notice that when you walk through the fire, you will not be scorched, nor will the flame burn you. And it describes God's presence dwelling with his people when they suffer pains of drowning or pains of fire. We've been introduced to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in Daniel chapter 1. When Daniel is tested regarding his diet and whether they're going to eat from the king's table or whether they're going to remain committed to their Levite, Hebrew, clean foods diet. And it talks about not only Daniel, but in verse 7 of Daniel 1, it describes the names of Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, those three worthies. And then, and because they passed this little test of diet and they didn't compromise, they were able to maintain their commitment to the God of Israel when they were asked to bow to the gods of Babylon. In Babylon, having a, how shall you say, a polytheistic adoption. In other words, the Hebrews were tolerated for their worship of their God because that God was just added to the other gods that all of the Babylonians just automatically worshipped. So, oh, you guys got a new God? Great. Bring them on in. Join our God club that we have. And so, you know, in Babylon, idolatry was the key to their worship. They had this temple to Marduk that Nebuchadnezzar embellished. And a key to their theology also was the worship of the king. And this type of deification of kings is not new to Babylon. The Egyptians did it as well with the pharaohs. Later on, Rome would do it with the Caesars. And exclusive of the Jews who were brought in from Jerusalem and from Israel and Judah, exclusive of the Jews whose religious convictions prohibited their bowing down before any image, ancient peoples did not object to worshiping idols. Hence, the refusal to bow down before Nebuchadnezzar's image would be regarded as proof of hostility towards Nebuchadnezzar and his government. And you had to look very carefully at the story to ask yourselves, are they the only Hebrew people in the whole crowd? In Daniel chapter 2, as we looked at a couple of weeks ago, the king is presented with a troubling dream. And he can't remember the dream. And he calls his sorcerers and he calls his magicians in. And he asks them not only to give him the dream that he dreamt, but to interpret the dream as well. And Daniel proved to be a type of Christ as he interceded on behalf of those various magicians and sorcerers. And he didn't take any credit for the dream as well. Any seasoned politician would have used this opportunity to get every other politician out of the way and claim the power for himself. But God exalted his humility. And at the end of chapter 2, remember, in verse 49, Daniel made request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was at the king's court. And so, these three Hebrews who were of noble and royal descent from Israel are now empowered and put into power in their land of the exile. Now, that's really rare. It doesn't happen in these types of places. And especially as it relates to Daniel chapter 3, because right in verses 1 and 2, we see the king's response to the dream. Let's go back quickly to look at the dream and examine the various metals in that statue. We had the head of gold, right? The chest and arms of silver. The thighs and belly of bronze, and the legs were of iron, and the feet were made of iron and clay, okay? And Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar are told, namely by Daniel, you are the head of gold, right? And so in Daniel chapter 3, what does King Nebuchadnezzar do? Did he set up, it would have been a lot cheaper actually to set up a golden head, a silver chest and arms. But what does he do? Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of what metal? The precious metal of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits, and its width 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. So this message that he got from God about his kingdom being the head of gold and then another kingdom coming after him, how did that sit well with Nebuchadnezzar regarding his actions here? He did not like that, did he? Because he's going to set up an image, literally, not just a dream, a literal image of all gold. Because he wants the kingdom of Babylon to endure forever. In fact, if he invites the princes of Medo-Persia and whoever is reigning in Greece at the time, and whoever is reigning in wherever is going on in Rome, if he invites all those people to Babylon and has them acknowledge the image of gold, they probably would be less likely to rise up and rebel and divert the aqueducts and come in under the gates. Here, you catch him following my drift here? He doesn't want his kingdom to pass away. Now, it describes here, had the image been completely solid gold, let's just speculate. If the image and its height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits, okay, you would need 8,262,807 pounds of gold. Yeah, they didn't have that much gold in Babylon, not digging around in that area in the sand and in between the rivers. And so it was probably outlaid in gold. It was probably framed, maybe of wood, and then overlaid with gold. And some scholars even point to perhaps even the pedestal was a massive height. In this picture we see it's got sort of a ziggurat type of a pedestal. Other images have other dimensions. But this statue is meant to impose the will of the king upon the other nations that would swear fealty to them. Verse 2, then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent word to assemble the satraps, the precepts, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Notice it's not called a worship service. It's called a dedication. You're going to dedicate the image. Now it sounds like a type of a event that could be a national event, right? We're setting up this monument, and we're going to memorialize it as a key monument in our kingdom, right? Everybody can join and come, but you notice here that what they did in verse 7, it says, therefore at that time, when all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, and all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. This was not just a national monument. This was not just a political rally. This was a worship service that had been established as a union. Are you following me here? A union of the kingdom and the religion. Babylon had done a union between the church and the state, and they had put the king up as the head of both entities. The king became the head of the state, and the king became the head of the church. And now watch what happens. You see, this herald goes forward, and it's fascinating to read through the whole chapter because you have these four sets of musical instruments, the various people who are supposed to be invited, they're repeated, and even Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego becomes a repetitious linguistic use that the writer gives to sort of give rhythm and rhyme to the narration. But in verse 8, for this reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. They responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of, and I'm just going to say the music, it is to fall down and worship the golden image, but whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. There are certain Jews, verse 12, whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely, who? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You see, one scholar points out that these Chaldeans are actually pointing the finger at the king. They're actually saying, look, you put these people in charge over us. We can't be surprised that they're not going to swear loyalty and fealty and bow down to the image that you have set up. And this is a device that these politicians use with these rulers in certain cases. We're going to see it also when we learn about Darius and how those wise men are pointing the finger at the king. You see, a clear reference to the promotion recorded at the close of chapter 2, which we read, the mention of the exalted official rank of these Jews was designed to emphasize the dangerous feature connected with the disobedience of such men. Also, to direct attention to the seriousness of their ingratitude toward their royal benefactor. Their words also contained a hidden insinuations against the king and virtually blamed him for a lack of political foresight by appointing to high administrative offices foreign prisoners of war from whom naturally no loyalty toward the Babylonian king and his gods could be expected. Thus, they implied the king should have foreseen. They're pointing to the Hebrews and say they're not bowing down, but really you should never have empowered them in the first place. Nebuchadnezzar responds, not to the Chaldeans, but he turns to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in verse 13. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then these men were brought before the king. You see, the payment of homage to the image would have given proof of subjection to the power of the king, but at the same time show a recognition that the gods of Babylon were supreme over all other local gods. That was what was at stake here. And if Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego had simply bowed down just to tie their shoe, or even to bow down and not pray to the idol, but pray to God at that time, just to go along with the culture, flow downstream with everybody else, it would have been a perceived acknowledgement of Babylon's power. And so it's a key story. In the gospel, apocalyptic book of Daniel and prophecy, he says, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up?" Throughout the chapter, there's an increasing emphasis on the religious aspects of this event. It starts out as just a dedication of the monument, and then it talks about the decree to bow down and worship the idol. Now, Nebuchadnezzar is plainly speaking about what is expected from all of those that are there gathered, hearing the music and bowing down and worshiping his gods. Nebuchadnezzar himself. Now, if you're ready, he's going to give him a second chance. Right? If you hear the music, just fall down and worship. But if you don't, you'll be immediately cast into the midst of a furnace. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? Huh? Key question, right? He should have known this already. Because God has already determined for Nebuchadnezzar his power through Daniel's revelation of the dream. But oh, how easily Nebuchadnezzar forgets. Aren't you glad you're not like him? Aren't you glad we're not like Nebuchadnezzar at all? We never forget how God has blessed us, right? We never forget how powerful God has been in our lives. Their response, they're not even going to need a second chance. They're not even going to need to hear the chorus of the song over again. Because as Andrew read, they respond, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God," this is the answer to the question, right? "Our God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God who delivered the Israelites out of Egypt, who parted the Red Sea, who passed over the blood on the doorpost, who provided manna in the wilderness, brought down the walls of Jericho," and so on and so forth and so on. If we read about him in the Old Testament, "that God is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king." And this is the incredible statement of faith that they make. In verse 18, and this is a challenge for all of us in our faith. "But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Even if they're burnt in the fire, that kind of a faith has eternal pictures in mind. Because, you know, what Jesus said is, let's not fear man or what man can do to us. Let's fear the Lord God of heaven, who has our eternal destiny in his power, who can rescue us from eternal fire. Prophets and Kings, page 507, their faith strengthened as they declared that God would be glorified by delivering them. And with triumphant assurance, born of implicit trust in God, they added, "But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up." I would plead to God for that kind of faith. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath. I love how the author describes. He was filled with wrath, and his facial expression was altered towards Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Sometimes we do the little emotion game with our kids. You know, show me surprise and show me happiness. I'd love to see a kid try and do this. Show me anger of Nebuchadnezzar in this story. He answered by giving orders to heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. And, of course, we understand and know that the men were bound. Individually, they were bound in all of their clothes as well. They were taken into the furnace, and one by one, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were all thrown in to the fiery furnace. And the 7 times exponential heat of the blazing furnace killed those men that threw them in. Immediately they were struck down and immediately they were burned up. This describes verse 23, these three men fell into the midst of the furnace, a blazing fire still tied up. Then, an incredible thing happens. Verse 24, Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded and stood up in haste. He said to his high officials, was it not 3 men we cast bound into the midst of the fire? So he qualifies what he threw in. There were 3 that were thrown in. They were all bound and they were thrown in to the furnace. And they replied, yeah, that's what happened. And he describes, something different is happening inside of there. Look, I see now 4 men that are loose and walking in the midst of the fire without harm. And the appearance of the 4th is like a son of the gods. Other versions of the Bible have the son of God. Now, you may ask, how does Nebuchadnezzar know what God looks like? Or how would he recognize his son? Ellen White gives some insight into that. The Hebrew captives filling positions of trust in Babylon had in life and character represented before him the truth. When asked for a reason of their faith, they had given it without hesitation. Plainly and simply, they had presented the principles of righteousness, thus teaching those around them of the God whom they worshipped. They had told of Christ, the Redeemer, to come. And in the form of the 4th, in the midst of the fire, the king recognized the Son of God. So the way that he recognized Jesus was because Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had displayed Jesus in their influence and in their lives. Can the people in our circle of influence say the same thing? I hope so. And so he calls them out. Ask them to come out, you servants of the Most High God, come here. And so they're loosed. But how many men come out of the fire? Yes. Only the 3 that were tossed in came out. And the incredible thing about that is all of these people who had been joined together worship an idol that had been set up, the idol of gold, ended up acknowledging the power of the Most High God through the 3 unharmed Hebrew worthies that came out of the fire. And so what started out as an idolatrous worship service turned into an acknowledgement of God's power through these Hebrew worthies. And then it even describes in verse 27, the fire had no effect on the bodies of these men, nor was the hair of their head singed, nor were their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of fire even come upon them. That's some kind of force field. I would love to have Jesus' force field around me like that all of the time. Talk about a Marvel hero, right? Jesus has this power to save these 3 Hebrew worthies from the fire. And then verse 28 takes a different turn because all of these people had to acknowledge the miracle that they had seen. Even Nebuchadnezzar himself, he bows down. He said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel, delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command and yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own God. And then he makes a mistake, right? We know that mistake is because in verse 29, he says, therefore, I make a decree than any people, nation, or tongue that speak against anything offensive against the God of these three shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way. No. That's not what God would want for the king to do, is it? God would not legislate worship of himself, because God is a God who values free will of all of us. And that's where Ellen White describes, it was right for the king to make public confession and to seek to exalt the God of heaven above all other gods, but in endeavoring to force his subject to make a similar confession of faith and to show similar reverence, Nebuchadnezzar was exceeding his right as a temporal sovereign. He had no more right, either civil or moral, to threaten men with death for not worshiping God than he had to make a decree consigning to the flames all who refused to worship the golden image. God never compels the obedience of man. He leaves all free to choose whom they will serve. From Prophets and Kings, page 510. And so, Adventists, living near the second coming of Jesus Christ, how do we understand this to apply to our lives? So what? Here's a poem that relates to us, unless it got inside. All the water in the world, however hard it tried, could never sink a ship unless it got inside. All the evil in the world, the wickedness and sin, can never sink the soul's craft unless it got inside. The challenge of Daniel chapter 3 is how far we're going to grow in our relationship with God and how far we're going to go to prove our loyalty to Him as our Savior and as our friend. Because to the loyal heart, this is from Prophets and Kings, page 511, to the loyal heart, the commands of simple, finite men will sink into insignificance beside the word of the eternal God. So three lessons that we can take from this. In summary, God sent His Son, Jesus, to be with us throughout the ordeals of this world. He was with those three Hebrew worthies, and He can be with all of us. Never compromise when the majority is following along. And even if suffering comes, the ultimate reality is better than compromise. While the Lord has not promised His people exemption from trials, He has promised that which is far better. He has said, as thy days, so shall thy strength be. My grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. References are there. If you are called to go through the fiery furnace for His sake, Jesus will be by your side, even as He was with the faithful three in Babylon. Those who love their Redeemer will rejoice at every opportunity of sharing with Him humiliation and reproach. The love they bear their Lord makes suffering for His sake sweet. That's a comment from Thoughts on the Mount of Blessings regarding the blessing on those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. I want to introduce you to one of the few men who had the opportunity to walk on the moon. Charlie Duke was on Apollo 16, and he walked on the moon for 3 days. He was allowed to be there, and they had the rover at that time, which they collapsed out of the module and drove around on the moon. And Charlie Duke became a Christian after his mission to the moon. When he came back, he saw his wife was converted, he saw a change in her, how her life began to reflect the life of Christ, and he wanted that same peace that she was experiencing. And in his testimony that he gives, he's invited around the world to speak, especially at this time during this anniversary. One of his incredible quotes that I love is, "A walk on the moon is 3 days, but a walk with Jesus is forever." You want to take that forever walk with Jesus Christ? I absolutely do. As in the days of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, so in the closing period of Earth's history, The Lord will work mightily in behalf of those who stand steadfastly for the right. He who walked with the Hebrew worthies in the fiery furnace will be with his followers wherever they are. His abiding presence will comfort and sustain. In Bible prophecy, we see in Revelation a compelling power. And this compelling power uses the death penalty to urge worship. It says in Revelation 13, 11, and 12, "Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon. He exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence, and he makes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose fatal wound was healed." God will never use compulsion to draw you to himself. His compulsion is love, his magnetic love. And he displayed that love for those three Hebrew worthies by being with them in the fire. I hope you experience the love of Jesus in your life this week.